White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, and now to White Rocket TV, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This episode is part two of our Questions About Everything two-part episode. I got about 40 minutes into a great set of questions last week, and on this episode, well, it really wasn't last week, it was like a couple of days ago, really, but anyway, on this episode, I'm going to pick back up with the rest of the questions that were left over when we got through the last one. So, I've got a great selection of questions about movies, TV, books, comics, and also about some of my own work, other authors and creators' work, so we're going to get right into that. Remember, you are watching the White Rocket Podcast and White Rocket TV, brought to you by WhiteRocketBooks.com. Visit WhiteRocketBooks.com. That's where you can find a whole lot of my books and a lot of books by other authors that I think that you will enjoy, as well as links to all of our podcasts that we've ever done. And to our sports site, the AU Wishbone. We have, of course, now made the now famous move to video. And so I'm very excited to be able to take advantage of some of the opportunities that video allows us in addition to what we've been able to do on the audio only. Of course, the audio will continue. So if you're listening to this on the podcast, on iTunes, or on some other way of listening to podcasts, you really won't miss out on much. Not really at all, but we're going to take advantage of some of the things that the visuals allow you to. Okay, so let's get right on into it with part two of Questions About Everything. I have my trusty, aging but still able to get the job done iPad standing by with questions from a variety of friends and readers and people who have followed me on the various social media. And by the way, we always do a good job, John and I, my co-host on the sports show, the AU Wishbone, of mentioning this, but I always kind of forget it on the air. So let me just point out, you can follow me on Facebook. I am Van Allen Plexico, Van A-L-L-E-N-P-L-E-X-I-C-O. You can follow me on Twitter, at Van Allen Plexico. Follow the show, the network, at White Rocket Book, singular, not enough letters, White Rocket at White Rocket Book. And the show has, of course, now a channel on YouTube. So just go on YouTube and search White Rocket TV. Actually, I'm assuming if you're watching this, you already know that. But if you're listening to the podcast, you can watch the show by searching for the White Rocket TV channel on YouTube. All right, let's get into it. Here are the second half of the questions that I received in the last few days. First up, a good broad question from Chai Sport on Twitter, and Chai Sport asks, who are your favorite fiction and nonfiction authors? Well, longtime listeners to this show will know pretty well who some of my favorite fiction and, of course, science fiction fantasy authors are, but I'll run through a few. Nonfiction, I don't know if we've talked about on here as much, so let's kind of get into it a little bit. In fact, quite a few of my favorite authors are right here behind me on these shelves. So I would say that in terms of fiction, not science fiction, but in fiction, my favorite authors include James Clavell. And of course, Rick Lye and I talked about the James Clavell Asian saga that includes books like Shogun, Noble House, Taipan, King Rat, Whirlwind. Those books we talked about on an earlier episode. So if you go to whiterocketbooks.com, you should be able to drop down the menu and find any episode that's ever been on this show. We're closing in on episode 100. Pretty amazing. And so one of the earlier, I think maybe in the 20s or 30s, Rick and I talked about the James Clavell Asian Saga. It is wonderful. Shogun is one of my five favorite books I've ever read. Noble House is right up there, too. These are fantastic books set in the last 200 or 300, 400 years of history as Europeans and Americans clash and get involved with the Japanese, the Chinese, and so on. Still thinking in terms of not of fiction, but not science fiction. Donald Westlake, who writes as Richard, he's passed away now, of course, but who wrote as Richard Stark. I mentioned in the last episode the Parker graphic novels, so this time I'm going to reach over and pull off the shelf. 1 second. Oh, there it is. The very first installment in Richard Stark, Donald Westlake's Parker novels. This is The Hunter. This book has been made into a movie at least twice. This is not Donald B. Parker, the author who writes crime novels, passed away, and now good old Ace Atkins, the Auburn defensive lineman, who's a great writer, is now carrying forward the series. I'm not talking about the writer Parker. I'm talking about the character Parker. In fact, if you've ever seen Leverage, the TV show Leverage, the blonde-headed female character on there, Parker, who was a thief, she was like an homage to this Parker. This book alone has been made into a movie with Lee Marvin back in what's called Point Blank. And then it was made into a movie again with Mel Gibson called Payback around 1999. Two different versions of that movie. Two almost completely different versions of that movie, too, that exist. Both are very good. A later Parker novel was recently made into a movie called Parker with Jason Statham. I love Parker. I love Jason Statham, but the two together, but it was still a decent movie. So they keep trying to make a good Parker movie. They've yet to totally succeed. But this is a series of something like 20 books. You'll see part of it right over here on my shelf, those of you watching on White Rocket TV. And it extends all the way to the end of that shelf. So really like Donald Westlake writing as Richard Stark, Parker. Fantastic. He's a criminal. He's a thief, but he's almost robotic. He's so single-minded and so smart. We did an episode about the Parker books. If you scroll down on the list of podcasts back to very early on, you will find the episode about Parker. Another fiction but not science fiction series that I love, and we did a show about this, was I'm going to reach down and get a copy to show you this. 1 second. I'm coming, I promise. Oh, wait, it's over here. Oh, this is good radio. All right, or TV, here you go. Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World was the name of the movie, but the book, I'm trying to get the glare off of it, there you go, Patrick O'Brien. Patrick O'Brien's Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin series, Napoleonic Wars, but it's as good as any Star Trek. Aubrey is basically Captain Kirk, but much more interesting, I promise. Dr. Maturin is basically McCoy and Spock combined, and at least as interesting. This is fantastic stuff. The whole Patrick O'Brien series, and there's 20 books in this series. That's some of my favorite. I have been getting into crime novels more lately, and I'll mention one more. I had listened to some Michael Connelly stuff. I'd listened to some Michael Connelly crime stuff after seeing the Lincoln Lawyer movie with Matthew McConaughey, and I like the Lincoln Lawyer character a lot. But his main character that Connelly writes is Detective Bosch, Harry Bosch. And I wasn't liking those books as much. I'd listened on audio to some of the later Bosch books from the library, and I was like, yeah, they're okay. But then I watched the Amazon series, the Amazon TV. It's kind of like Netflix. You know, Amazon has their own production company now. Amazon did a series last year with Titus Welliver from Deadwood called Bosch. And they took two or three of the early Bosch novels and turned them into like a 10-episode series. Fantastic. Great, great, great TV. So after that, I just went a couple of weeks ago and picked up... This is actually book two. I wasn't as interested in book one. I just skipped right ahead to book two. Don't ask me why. I don't know. I blew through this in like a week. Really, really good. The Black Ice by Michael Connelly. It's the second Bosch novel. I picked up Concrete Blonde at Barnes & Noble last night. It is book three in the Bosch series. So I've kind of read the later books, and now I'm going back and reading the beginning. And this is really good stuff, really good stuff. I know I'm forgetting all kinds of other... Oh, you know what? I'm going to mention one more. Let me roll my chair over here again for just a second and grab an example. Here we go. Yeah. Joe Lansdale. Everybody loves Joe R. Lansdale, right? I mean, he's fantastic. This is kind of crime novel, kind of comedy, humor, wacky Texas stuff. Nobody writes weird, wacky Texas like Joe Lansdale. And so the Happ and Leonard series, I want to say they're making a TV series out of this. But it's two very, very wacky characters in the middle of rural East Texas. And they are, they team up to fight crime, but like the Texas mafia and drug lords and, you know, white slavery rings and weird stuff like that. So, but it's really funny. It's extremely funny. So, and there's several of those books from Lansdale. So I totally recommend them. I'm almost caught up. I haven't read the whole series yet. Okay. So again, I know I'm forgetting quite a few, like the Sherlock Holmes original canon. I read all of them and they're fantastic. Oh, there's all kinds of stuff, but we got to get in it. We got to move along. So, I'll leave off science fiction because you guys know, I mean, Roger Zelazny, Larry Niven, Frank Herbert, John Varley, you know, I love science fiction and always have. Right up here behind me, see the Black Library, Dan Abnett and Graham McNeil. Friend of the show, Graham McNeil. Friend of the show, Josh Reynolds. These guys write for the Black Library, the Warhammer and Horus Heresy stuff. These are the Gaunt's Ghosts hardbacks that I have right here. Oops, hit my headphones. And so, yeah, I totally, totally love that. Absolutely love it. Nonfiction real fast. My favorite nonfiction writer currently is probably, I hope I don't knock all this over, probably Bill Bryson. And I just picked this up last night too, The Road to Little Dribbling. I just love it. This is Adventures of an American in Britain. And so it's kind of funny because Bryson seems to move back and forth between the United States and Britain like every 10 or 15 years, it seems like. And every time he does, he writes a book about either the one or the other. So he's now written at least 4 books on going from the U.S. to Britain or going from Britain to the U.S. and what it's like and how different it is. The first one was called Notes from a Small Island, and then there was Made in America and I'm a Stranger Here Myself, and so Road to Little Dribbling. But they're all very entertaining. I know some people don't like him that much, don't like his stuff, but I think it's fantastic. It also works really well on audiobook. His stuff is hilarious on audiobook. We just saw the movie A Walk in the Woods with Robert Redford and Nick Nolte. That was based on his story about walking the Appalachian Trail. So The Road to Little Dribbling, I have just started. You can see I'm on like page 3. So I'll let you know down the road. In fact, that would be a good topic for a White Rocket show in the future, would be Bill Bryson, his books. We could just talk about, spend about 5 or 10 minutes on each one. I guess I need to get John Ringer, my occasional co-host here and permanent co-host on the Wishbone. I'll get John to read all the Bryson books. John reads a lot faster than me, so he probably could do it in 6 months, if not less. And then we'll do a show on Bryson. Okay. The other nonfiction I read is mostly political or historic, stuff like the Robert Caro books on the years of Lyndon Johnson. Those are fantastic. I'm just learning so much about politics and American history in the 50s and 60s right now. I'm reading the current one is called Passage of Power. And but I'm not going to bore you to death with that because I know a lot of you probably wouldn't be interested. But that would be an awesome show to do a show on Lyndon Johnson and Robert Caro's biographies. This is a guy that's devoting his entire life to telling the life story of President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, LBJ. So maybe we'll do a show on that. If you don't like it, you can skip that episode. Okay. All right, moving along. That was a good question, very broad question. It took up a good bit of our time. I have no idea. Oh, yeah, like 14 minutes. Okay, well, let's move along. Jimbo. Oh, this one could take a while, too. Getting these up front. I promise I've got some shorter, snappier questions coming up as we go, so stick with me. But this one's a good one, too, in a different way. Jimbo asks, I'd like to know more about your past and your decision to become a writer and how and why you made the transition, your expectations versus your experience, and your plans for the future. Also, throw in your biggest challenges, too, and how you dealt with them. Wow, that could be two whole episodes by itself, but let me kind of see what I can do to make that entertaining for everybody and zip through it. I'm going to have to take it step by step, okay? First, more about your past. Well, my past is very simple. I grew up in Sylacauga, Alabama, in East Central Alabama, just about 40 miles south of Birmingham. Perhaps you can detect it in my voice. I don't know. I grew up out in the woods, and so all we really had, I didn't have anybody my age hardly within 10 square miles in any direction. And so all the way up until I had a driver's license, what did I do? I watched 1970s television or before, and including Star Trek, Space 1999, you know, Lost in Space, $6 Million Man. And I read comic books and paperback books. On those rare occasions when we would get to have a reason to go to Birmingham, I would beg and plead to go by one of the bookstores in one of the malls in Birmingham, and I would buy as many paperbacks as I could afford that looked interesting. I was always very picky, so that usually meant a bunch of Larry Niven or Roger Zelazny or John Varley books, you know, something like that. And that would do me until the next time. I would always borrow some change. I'd always go up to my granddad at the grocery store and say, Granddaddy, can I have 32 cents or 37 cents? And he'd you know, grudgingly piece out 37, 32 cents for me, which would be just enough with tax to buy a comic book. And, you know, some of the other kids in my class made fun of me for reading comic books. It was not as cool then as it is now, apparently. But, man, that was my escape. I loved it, and it really made me who I am. Reading the Avengers and Iron Man and other, you know, great early Marvel stuff, the Claremont Byrne X-Men and all that kind of stuff. And then reading Justice League and Green Lantern and stuff from DC. That was the, you know, Jim Starlin, David Michelinie, Doug Moench, Bill Mantlow, Jim Shooter. You know, those guys were my... That's the foundation of who I am as a creative person is those, and George Perez for the art, of course, and Steve Rude, Mike Barron. If you're watching Mike, we disagree on everything except the fact, I don't know how you feel about it, but I think you're one of the greatest comics writers there's ever been, and really, really respect the work that you and Steve Rude did over the years on Nexus. Again, that was another one of those things that totally shaped me as a creative person reading that stuff. Okay, that's my past. So, you know, because I was so bored, I had all these things to absorb when I was a kid. And so when I was in high school, I knew I wanted to write. I'd always wanted to do the kind of thing I enjoyed reading. I wanted to make comic books. I'd make them up like a, you know, as a kid. I'd make my own little comic books. I was typing novels or writing them longhand in notebooks as early as 6th, 7th, 8th grade, you know. Probably typed my first full novel and sent it off to a publisher in I believe, 9th or 10th grade. And so I always wanted to do it. It's the only thing I ever really wanted to do from the very moment I ever discovered books. I was dictating books that before I could even write to my dad and my sister. You know, I'm sure that Lisa remembers helping me write some little book I was writing about adventures that some rabbit had in the woods. I don't know. This was when I was in kindergarten, so... I've always wanted to write. It's not that I wanted to be a writer and anything that goes with that. I mean, that's all well and good. I'm not one of these people that puts a lot of stock in author, you know, Joe Smith or whatever. I mean, that's fine. But what I, you know, if nobody even reads it, and hopefully people are reading it, people are buying them. But if nobody's even reading it, it's just I have stories that I want to tell. They have to come out. They have to come out. I mean, there's stories that I sit down and make up and craft. Like if somebody says, we'd like you to be in this anthology and we need you to write a 15,000 word or a 8,000 word or 10,000 word story about so-and-so, I'll sit down and create that, craft that from nothing. But as far as the stuff that I do on my own, the Shattering Legion stuff with Lucian and Baranak over here, or the Sentinels, that was just stuff that's in my head. There's no crafting there. It just comes out. You know, I'm just the stenographer translating it out. So that had to come out, no matter who's reading it. So it's not about being a writer. It's about writing. It's about just doing it, getting it done, get it out, and then being proud of it and getting to enjoy it once it's out. Let's see. How and why you made the transition? Well, there wasn't really a transition. The transition was basically being born. That was it. That was my transition to writing. Your expectations versus your experience. My expectations were that I would spend my entire life writing stuff that publishers would not really want to publish because I was writing it the way I wanted it to be rather than the way editors and publishers wanted it to be. And so the miracle that has brought me out to the public and so many others in the last 10 years or so has been small press publishing. And, you know, Amazon and ebooks and all the various things that have happened that have enabled more people to get out there. The revolution in publishing in the last 10 years is very analogous to what happened when you went from three or four channels on the TV, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, to eventually suddenly you have 100 and something channels on cable. You know, so small press publishing is like the cable TV of books and publishing. You know, Random House, Tor, Bayon, Ballantine, these are the networks. But we're out here in HGTV land. We're out here in Nat Geo TV. We're out here in A&E, you know, if not lower than that. But that still gets an audience. It still reaches an audience. To paraphrase the bit from the Howard Stern movie where they totally got this right. Remember the guy told Howard, we're not narrowcasting, we're broadcasting. Well, publishing today both broadcasts and narrowcasts, and being able to narrowcast has meant that an audience has my book has reached an audience and an audience has discovered my books. That's been the difference. Your plans for the future. I'm going to keep going the way I have been going with most of my stuff, but I have to admit that every so often I feel like I am really meant at some point. I'm meant, and I don't mean that in an arrogant, egotistical way. I promise you, I don't mean it that way. I just honestly in my heart, I feel like I am supposed to have some stuff published by one of the big quote-unquote network publishers. If that never happens, it never happens, right? But I just feel like I'm writing of a level of quality now that could make it there. The only thing that holds me back is that they actually, you know, have deadlines. They actually have editorial control that can shape what your story you're telling. And that's all well and good. That's professional and that's what they do. And I totally get it. But one of the things, as long as I have a full-time, overtime job, you know, I teach 19 college classes a year, every year, 19 college classes. I'm pretty tired at the end of the day. I've been performing for hours from 8 o'clock in the morning until maybe 7 o'clock at night. And so as long as I'm trying to devote my all to being the best college professor I possibly can be and educating my students and getting them interested in stuff, as long as I'm doing that, I'm doing the rest of it A, for fun, and B, because I have to get it out. But I don't want to be constrained by somebody else's deadlines or somebody else's content restrictions or content preferences. as long as I'm doing it purely for my own sake and for the readers that enjoy it, that I know are out there, I want to do it on my own terms. So there's going to come a day when I try to get in with Bayon or Tor or, you know, Black Library or somebody. And I honestly think that I can. But right now, that's just that wouldn't make me happy relative to how much work it would take to do it. So I hope that made sense. And then we'll talk about books coming up in the future at the very end of this episode. Oh, throw in your biggest challenges, how you dealt with them. Well, I think the biggest challenge I faced early on that's kind of been overcome is before the proliferation of small press and micro publishing and everything in ebooks, the biggest challenge I faced was I felt like the only way anybody would ever get to read my books was if I conformed my writing to what the big publishing houses wanted. Okay. It kind of gets back to what I was just saying. I felt like I was going to have to write stuff that conformed to what Del Rey wanted or what Bayon wanted or what Tor wanted. And that's, you know, I knew that wasn't really me at the time. I want to write pulp, right? One of the biggest revelations in my life was discovering that I am, to a certain degree, truly a new pulp writer rather than a classic science fiction writer. You know, I'm not into all the sociological stuff so much. I'm not into all the deep soul-searching stuff. I like a cracking story that moves along at fast pace. That's what most people tend to say about my work, if you haven't read it, is it's fast-paced, it's fun, it's colorful. And, you know, in other words, I'm trying to write Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars rather than 2001 A Space Odyssey or Gorillas in the Mist or Out of Africa or something like that, you know. So that's my biggest challenge was that, and then I discovered a way out, which was to become a small press pulp writer rather than a mainstream science fiction writer that just was not me. So let's see, moving along. Thank you, Jimbo. That was a really awesome sort of in-depth question. I hope that we didn't just put the audience to sleep. Let's see. Scott, well, I'm going to take a break here just for a second and get something to drink. That's a tasty beverage. Woo, lemonade from Casey's General Store. Because the Walton family needs more free advertisement. Okay. Scott asks, what's the main difference between superhero novelizations versus superhero movies? Well, you know what? I think there's four things. Four things. There's superhero comics. There's superhero movies, loosely based on those comics. There's superhero novelizations of the movies. Okay? And then there are superhero novels. Now, let me break those down really quick, and I think when I do that, it'll answer that question more or less. First, you have superhero comics. And for most of history, that has been where the cutting edge of the superhero universe, whatever one you're talking about, lived, right? In other words, if somebody was going to die, if a major character was going to die, if the status quo was going to change, it would happen in the comics. So if there was a movie or a TV show based on those characters, they generally would not make major changes there unless they happened in the comics first, right? So if Aunt May died in the comics, then maybe Aunt May would die in the movie or the TV show. But they wouldn't just kill off Aunt May usually in the TV show or the movie if she's still alive in the comics. Now, again, in recent years, there's just been so much that you can find some exceptions. You can find some examples where I'm wrong, and that's fine. But I'm just saying, historically, that was the case, that the comic books drove the bus, and everything else rode on the bus and reacted to what the bus driver was doing. You see, so comic books were the pulling the way; everything else followed in the comic books' wake. Now, what's happened recently is that the movies have gone from being mostly kind of jokes. You know, occasionally you'd have a Batman, or occasionally you'd have a some comic related movie that would be successful. But in the last few years, as we all know, the last decade, superhero-related comic book-based movies have exploded, right? They've taken off. And so now, in some ways, the movies are driving the comics. They're beginning, at least Marvel. I'm not sure about DC. In fact, I think maybe DC is doing this now that I mention it. Just recently heard. But both Marvel and DC, to some degree or other, have begun to let what happens in the movies go back and dictate how the comics are. You know, in other words, they're making the comic books more like how things are in the movies. Now, honestly, that's probably a smart choice, because way more people are watching the movies than have ever read the comics. It's just a fact. And so I get it. I don't have to like it, but I get it. Now, then there are superhero movie novelizations. And a novelization, any novelization, when you use the word novelization, what that means is you're taking something that's been made in another medium and making a novel out of it. So, like, you know, think about, you know, George Lucas / Alan Dean Foster wrote the novelization of Star Wars. In other words, George Lucas and whoever else wrote the script of Star Wars, and they're going to film the movie. And meanwhile, Alan Dean Foster, writing under George Lucas's name, wrote it as a fleshed out prose narrative, a novel. I have several very good friends who do that. Good old Keith DeCandido, of course. He's made a living for many years, first and foremost, as a novel writer of novels based on movies and TV shows and games and other things. So that's a novelization. And here's the thing about how they're different. Novelizations can never deviate from the movie unless it's they're using, you know, an earlier script or something, and then it's kind of accidental that they're deviating. The only way that novelizations can be different from the movie or show they're based on is if they are allowed to include stuff in the novelization that was edited out of the movie or the TV show, but is still canonical, right? In other words, it still counts. It still could have happened, but they just wanted to cut it out of the movie for pacing reasons or something, or to make the movie shorter, you know? And so it's kind of like if, and this is kind of funny when you think about it, you know, my good friend Joe Crow, he used to joke that he wrote the novelization of Lord of the Rings, which is, you know, hilarious because it was a novel first and then a movie. You don't really have a novelization of a movie based on a novel. You just have the novel. You know, you don't need to write another book. But let's say they had, okay? Let's say that you wrote a novelization of the Lord of the Ring of the Lord of the Rings movies, and you wrote it, and all that was out there were the theatrical releases. Well, then the novelization could have all that stuff that was in the extended versions of the movies, you see? So you'd take like a three and a half hour Return of the King and make a 4.5 hour version as the novelization. Okay. But see, then there's superhero novels, and they are a fourth thing, because superhero novels are original. In other words, they are not generally based on a pre-existing story. So you could have Peter David write a novel about the Hulk. It'd be an original story that had never been told in any other format, any other medium. But generally a superhero novel like that, based on existing characters, existing properties, they're not driving the bus. Remember, they're on the bus. The comic books and now the movies drive the bus. And so an original novel like that can't change the status quo. You couldn't kill the Hulk in a novel like that. Everything has to be kind of back on the shelf where the writer got it down to play with it in the story by the end of the story. But original superhero novels, which is what I do, right? The Sentinels. With original superhero novels, you can do whatever you want because they don't exist probably in any other medium. So they are the driver of the bus and the entire bus for their little world. So in the Sentinels stories, I could have my entire cast get killed in book three, and who's to tell me no? Right? Because there's no movie universe yet. There's no TV show. There's no anything else. There's no comics. So original superhero novels can do whatever they want, but novels based on superheroes in other media, they are constrained to not do anything permanent change-wise because they don't get to drive the bus. So that's, I think, one of the reasons that I don't enjoy licensed, you know, existing character superhero novels as much, is because I know that nothing of true significance is going to happen in the story. It will not be reflected later in any other way. Whereas original superhero novels are great because anything goes. They are the comics of their universe, and so anything goes. All right. Let's see. Ralph asks, 3 days ago, well, maybe 4 days ago now, oops, I just did something terrible to my iPad. There we go. Was the 22nd anniversary of the premiere of Babylon 5. Yay! I guess that would be the premiere of season one, not The Gathering, which was the pilot movie. That would be like Midnight on the Firing Line, the first season of... I can just name the names of random episodes of Babylon 5 in the right order. I probably should seek help. So yeah, Midnight on the Firing Line was 22 years ago this past week. Yet today, he says, if you asked the current generation of sci-fi fans, what do you think of Babylon 5? They, for the most part, would look at you blank-faced. That's fair. That is tragic, but it's fair. And so he goes on, what do you, I guess he means me, think Babylon 5's legacy or lasting impression is upon the face of sci-fi, and do you think we'll ever see its like again? Do you think the series or characters will be resurrected in TVs or movies anytime in the near future? Great question, and it's right in my wheelhouse emotionally because I do love Babylon 5 so very much. First, let me just say, since he brought up Babylon 5, there they are. If you're watching on White Rocket TV, there's the 6 DVD cases. I've also got, you'll see right there is Crusade, and there are the other TV movies, Legend of the Rangers, about which the less said the better. And then here's the sort of almost home video made DVD that they did called The Lost Years. But here's the series proper over here. I need to watch the whole thing again sometime. I watched it all the way through probably 4 times when it first aired back in the mid to late 90s. Well, let's take his questions one by one. What do you think Babylon 5's legacy or lasting impression is upon the face of sci-fi? I think that the one thing Babylon 5 did that made a bigger mark than anything else and that changed television as we know it is the idea of the serialized ongoing story. I've heard people refer very incorrectly to Babylon 5 as a science fiction soap opera. It's not a soap opera. Soap operas have continuity from episode to episode. Yes, I get that. But they never end. Soap operas are completely open-ended. That's why you get the famous or the infamous twin brother, twin sister, person back from the dead, long-lost, you know, relative appearing, that kind of stuff, because they just have to keep the ball rolling as long as the advertisers will buy advertising time on it. Babylon 5 was planned from the very beginning as a closed, finite story. There was not going to be a Babylon 6. It just wasn't. And so what that means is that the true analogy is not a soap opera. The analogy is miniseries like Roots or The Winds of War or Shogun or Masada. Babylon 5 was a miniseries that did not run 5 nights. It's a miniseries that ran 5 years. But it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Finite from the very beginning. And so before Babylon 5, there was not really much, if any, television drama that was not episodic. meaning something happened in this episode and it was over. And in the next episode with the same characters, you have something else happen. But there was not much backstory going on. There was not many subplots. You know, you had the A plot, maybe a little bit of a B plot. That was it. Babylon 5 gave you an A plot, a B plot, a C plot, maybe a D plot. And all but one of them would be ongoing, and the one that wasn't would come back later. So I think that the story structure, the series structure of Babylon 5 is the huge change. And everything works that way now. Nothing worked that way before. I've always said, imagine if Star Trek had worked that way, how cool it would have been, the original Star Trek. You know, if in the middle of season two, Captain Kirk had declared the Enterprise independent, and the next episode it was still independent. That would have been amazing. Instead of episodic. You know, I think The Simpsons went a long way to showing how episodic TV can be so silly. And they do it on purpose, right? Because they'll have just horrific things. You know, Homer might turn into Godzilla and the city blow up and the nuclear power plant melt down. And the next episode, everything's back to normal. And when you see that, you realize how absurd episodic TV is by comparison with Babylon 5 style ongoing storytelling. So... okay, phone's beeping again, sorry. So I think that's the legacy. I don't know that... see, I think that one of the main problems Babylon 5 has always faced in terms of its legacy as a science fiction property with future viewers, with young viewers who are coming up, getting old enough to enjoy it, is it, you know, parts of it, especially back in the mid-90s, looked spectacular. You know, understand, they were making this show for like $12 an episode, filming it in an old abandoned hot tub factory, and all the special effects were CGI. First time ever that all the spaceship effects and stuff were CGI. So, you know, it looks amazing for what it was, but when you compare it to something that's got a millions and millions of dollar budget, especially nowadays filmed in HD, in widescreen, you know, and all that, it's just not going to hold up as well. So Babylon 5 as a story holds up great, but people have to get past, they have to get past the surface impression, Londo with the hair, you know, that runs off viewers as much as anything. People see Londo come out with the hair and they're like, oh, what is this? And they turn it off, you know. So viewers have to get past the superficialities that resulted from the show being made on a shoestring budget and get into the story, this incredible multi-layered ongoing space opera story. And if they can do that, they will be immensely rewarded. Will we see its like ever again? I mean, well, I think everything is like it now. That's the thing. I mean, in terms of structure, almost everything is done the way Babylon 5 was, and that's great. But in terms of one giant space opera with a constrained story with an ending, I don't know that we'll see that again, simply because networks and TV institutions, they don't want to know going in that something's going to end. They want to be able to milk it for every penny it will milk for until the people get sick of it. You know, so I'm inclined to say no, we'll never see it again. Will they do a movie? Will they do a new TV series with new actors and maybe better effects and better makeup and everything? Well, that would be nice. I'd be willing to watch it. I'd give it a try. I'd hope they wouldn't dumb it down any. I'd hope that Joe Straczynski would be involved somehow. But, you know, there are other things I'd rather see first that have never been done. We've still got Babylon 5. Look, it's right here. I'm touching Babylon 5 right now on my shelf, the box sets. We've got Babylon 5. I'd like other things to be done first. We need a Chronicles of Amber miniseries on HBO immediately. Please, somebody out there that's influential, please film me a Chronicles of Amber HBO series. Perry asks, how do you approach writing your superhero books? Clearly, what is that? How do I approach writing my superhero books? Clearly not fast enough lately. You know what I do, and it's kind of how I approach writing everything, is I gather up ideas. I mean, just constantly I'm vacuuming up, accumulating ideas. And they don't necessarily come from reading other superhero stories at all. I haven't read very many superhero stories in several years now. What I do is read other things and watch other things. And all those ideas kind of come down in the hopper, right? They bounce around, and I think, oh, that was a cool scene that I saw in such and such, or I read in such and such a book. How could I use something similar to that? You know, what would it be like if some of my characters were in a similar situation? What would they do? And so I'm constantly gathering in ideas, from everything I've ever read or watched or whatever. And they're just like little rubber balls bouncing around inside a big hopper. And occasionally a couple of them will stick together, and then another one will stick to it. And when enough little things stick together, sort of metaphorically in my mind, I'll stop and I'll examine it, and I go, oh, okay, so this could happen, and this could happen, and this person would be really good to do this. And so they recombine in new ways that are original as anything is, right? But still, make good storylines. So I generally have several things going at once. I have like a basic outline of where I want a story to go. So, for example, with the Sentinels, I know pretty much what happens in Book 8 and Book 9 that I'm about to write. I know where I want things to be at the end of Book 9, the end of that trilogy. Then I start finding little pieces of story that I can glue in, like plugging Legos into a board, right? That I can, along the way. And when I get enough of those in place that I kind of feel like I've got a whole story, now I start writing it. And as I'm writing it and come to gaps, I can just fill in those gaps as I go with new ideas. So no matter how much I outline, I'm never bored with it, because there's always new layers and new layers and new layers to lay down on top of that existing material. And so that works for me, you know. I mean, just constantly thinking. I mean, I've gone back in second and third drafts and added whole new scenes or changed scenes around because I thought of something that I felt like would work a lot better, would be more creative, more original, more interesting. You know, I'm not trying to just get from A to Z. I'm not trying to get from point A to point Z. I'm trying to make the trip fun. I want that trip to be, let's say, you know, like, here, if I just say, and he did this, and he did this, he did Z, that's boring. And then I think, well, what if he did this? And then he did this. He did this. Okay, boom. Well, that's a little more interesting. But what if I say this, 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 this? Now, see, it's starting to get interesting. So I'm just constantly trying to plug in more scenes, more events, more interconnection, you know. At some point, you have to cut it off, because I would still be writing Wind Strikes the Warlord if I had not just said, all right, that's enough. You know, let's move on. But I'm always trying to come up with new ideas and plug new things in. And that's true really for any book, but especially for superheroes, because those books have a big cast. You know, they have a big cast. They have a lot of subplots and sub-subplots. And I need everybody to have something to do. And in fact, another way of approaching writing superhero books is, I keep a list of all the characters, good and bad and whatever else, supporting, villainous, whatever, open all the time, or written down or somewhere accessible when I'm writing, so that I always know who's available, who I can plug in, who I can bring in, who I'm forgetting to use. Oh gosh, I haven't used that character in 30 pages, you know. Just so it's always not out of sight, out of mind. Okay. So, you know, beyond that, I mean, writing superhero books, the last thing I'll say about it is this. I've always felt like writing superhero books, for me, is like writing any kind of a science fiction story. It's just that the characters themselves have the abilities rather than using some kind of tool, right? Here's the analogy that I've used before. It's like if you're writing a Star Trek novel, honestly, the crew of the Enterprise are superheroes. They can teleport from here to here, right? They can zap you with a phaser beam that'll disintegrate you or knock you out, stun you. They can communicate over vast distances. They can travel faster than light. You better believe the crew of the Enterprise are superheroes. The difference is they're using equipment to do those things, right? They're using devices. But a lot of superheroes use devices and equipment to do their superpower things. There's just a few of them that are more mutant-like and have natural occurring power. But it still works the same way in terms of storytelling. You know, whether Pulsar has a force field projecting gun or whether Pulsar is just zapping a force field out of her body, you know, for the most part, it amounts to the same thing. So I approach writing superhero novels just like writing any other kind of science fiction adventure story. It's just that the characters are a little more colorful, a little more basic, more vivid, and some of them actually have their powers internally rather than carrying stuff around with them. And it's just part of it, too, is just a feel. Like if I have a new idea for something, I can usually tell, will it fit into my Sentinel superhero type universe, or does it belong in more like a Mars McCoy, a little more cheesy but still fun, you know? Or does it fit in the Shattering and Hawk? And you can usually look at any idea and say, that idea really fits in with Hawk, you know, or that idea fits in the Shattering versus, you know, oh, that idea, that's something the Warlord would do. That's something that Wolf would do. You know, let's put that in the Sentinels, you know. So you can usually tell. Okay. Jim asks, with convention season getting ready to start up again, yes, it is, although I won't be at Mid-South Con this year. If those of you out there in Tennessee going to Memphis to Mid-South, I hate to say, but it's on Mira's birthday this year, so I had to email them and tell them I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be able to come this year. And I really hate it because I enjoy Mid-South. Always some good, fun people to hang out with. What is the best Dragon Con story you can tell, Jim asks. What's the best Dragon Con story I can tell? Well, here's another one where you can scroll back. And Keith DeCandido and I did an episode about a year and a half ago on one of our White Rocket episodes talking about our favorite Dragon Con stories. And I told quite a few. I tell the one where I'm standing next to John DeLancey at the urinal in the bathroom, and it dawns on me that I'm peeing with Q. There's, you know, the first time I ever met George Perez after talking to him online for a while, and he just got up and yelled, "Van," and hugged me, and, you know, he's just, I mean, I'm sure he does everybody that way, but it just was so amazing to me, you know? And, but I mean, there have been so many fun stories at Dragon Con, good and bad. Getting to take Maddie and Mira and Amy there, you know, several occasions was great. Let them kind of see it through their eyes for the first time was fun. And, you know, getting to meet so many people that I've been a fan of for my whole life. We talked about this in the last episode about meeting so many writers. I guess, you know, getting to be on a panel and moderate for John and DeLynn, was just mind blowing. Getting to sit on a panel of writers where it was me, John Ringo, and, several other, you know, big time writers, and by that big time I mean John, not me, obviously. I'm not big time at all, but working on it. That was pretty cool to be considered a peer of theirs. Sawyer, Robert J. Sawyer was on that panel, Ringo was on that panel, and several others. And I mean, that's pretty neat. I've gotten to be on a lot of panels over the years at different conventions with writers that I have great respect for, and it's just an honor. You know, most recently, Harlan Ellison. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. So, let's see. Scott asks, if I think of a really good Dragon Con story I haven't told before, I did have to break up a fight between aliens in the Babylon 5 live-action roleplay one time. And what was funny was I never thought about it, but I was role playing as Captain Sheridan. I have my Babylon 5 black uniform on, and we were doing the council, the non-aligned, you know, the council of humans and Vorlons and Centauri and Minbari and whatever. And then the Narn, and then the non-aligned worlds. And, you know, in the show, the non-aligned worlds are always squabbling, and there's, you know, Sheridan trying to settle everything down, or Ivanova, if he's not there. And or her way of settling things down is to throw gasoline on it. And we actually had a real-life, almost physical altercation between two of the alleged, quote-unquote, alien ambassadors. And I had to kind of stand between them and stop the fight. And it was as if the shadows had come in and egged them on to fight. And there I am as Sheridan actually trying to get them not to fight. Wow, that's funnier than I ever realized at the time. At the time, I was freaking out thinking I'm going to get banned from Dragon Con for putting on an event where people get in a fight. Now I realize I was actually living the role I was LARPing. Wow, that's crazy. Okay. Scott asked, where do you get your ideas? And then he ducks. Where do you get your ideas? My favorite Harlan Ellison story along those lines, Harlan Ellison used to say that people would ask him, where do you get your ideas? He'd say, well, there's a place in New Jersey, and you send them $5 in a stamped self-addressed envelope, and they send you back an idea. There ought to be a place that does that. That would be such a great idea. There's your idea, people. Start up, you know, the Idea Factory, and have people send you $5, and you email them back a story cue. You're welcome. Enjoy. But where do I get my ideas? I was describing it sort of a minute ago that really just from consuming everything, you know, you read books, you watch TV, you watch movies, you read comics, you do all these things and you get all these ideas. And of course, nothing is original anymore and hadn't been for like a million years. But what you're doing is you're getting little pieces of ideas and they're all jumbled together like ping pong balls in the lottery thing, right? And eventually they start to stick together, but in different ways than they were originally. So it becomes original to you, right? It becomes original to you in the sense that it's a new combination made up of pieces of stuff that's been recycled a million times. That's just how storytelling is. You recycle things that have been told a million times, and you do the million and first version original the way you want it. And if people like it, they'll come back for a million and two and a million and three. So I get my ideas just from being a sponge for all media. And as I always tell aspiring writers and creators, do not just read and watch stuff in the genre you want to work in. In fact, I'd almost say avoid that. I get a lot of my ideas for superhero or science fiction stuff from reading history and from reading a lot of nonfiction. I said before that the Shattering Trilogy here, a big part of the inspiration of it was reading Lord Norwich's History of the Byzantine Empire. You know, it helps to be somebody who is interested and enjoys that kind of thing, certainly. But I mean, reading about the actual Roman emperors and the crazy bloody stuff that they did gave me ideas of what a space empire could do, right? You just take those little pieces of ideas of what the real Roman Empire and the emperors did, and you bounce them all around and you recombine them in a different order, but on other worlds, in a galactic empire setting, you know. I read the Patrick O'Brien stuff, and you translate some of that from 19th century Age of Sail and cannons to spaceships. You know, there's David Weber and others have done that. I'm not talking literally. In fact, honestly, let me rephrase that. I really haven't gotten much in the way of combat ideas from Patrick O'Brien stuff. What I've really more gotten from Patrick O'Brien is the character stuff, just the way the characters relate to each other. Just new ways of having conversations among your characters, new ways of having confrontations and dialogue, you know. Just I draw inspirations for dialogue from everywhere, you know, in everyday life, from clever turns of phrase. I've probably gotten more dialogue ideas from Shakespeare. Oh, man, the stuff that he throws out there, it just sounds so good that when you hear an actor do it on stage or when you read it, it just sounds so good. It sounds so good in your head that it sticks in there and bounces around. And so, like, you know, here I'm using the visual power of White Rocket TV now to kind of do in my hands. Like, so here's this Shakespeare 6 or 7 words, a way of saying something. Now, here's something I need a character to say. And I'll go, hey, they could kind of say it that way. And it would sound very memorable and cool, right? And so if you read particularly my Shattering books, if you read this series over and over, probably on every 10th or 11th, 12th page, you will find a turn of phrase of somebody's dialogue that is very heavily influenced by Shakespeare. And that is probably 50% conscious and 50% subconscious. So let's see. The iPad has gone to sleep, like probably much of the audience. I hope I'm not boring you to death. We only got a couple more to go. Let's see. Last couple of questions. We're nearing the end. Several people ask, what do you have coming up next? Right. Well, I mentioned a little bit of this on the last episode that I'm working on Sentinels Volume 8, The Dark Crusade, and then we'll do Sentinels Volume 9. That'll round out that trilogy. Hopefully, I'll have both of those out within the next year or so. I'm expecting Volume 8 to be out by this summer. I've already written a bunch of it. And I know exactly what happens all the way through 9. It's just a matter of having a chance to sit down and write it. Alpha Omega will continue. I'm nearly done with episode 4 of that, which is the near future sort of military sci-fi, sort of Space 1999 update that I'm doing for Prose. It's only on Kindle, I believe, so look on Amazon for that. Like I mentioned, I really want to get a new Falcon. I want to get a Falcon novel to be a sequel to Hawk there, back behind the Battlestar Galactica and behind my little bobblehead Iron Man. That'll be fun. I have the plot for Falcon already plotted out. I know exactly what happens in that book. And I'm going to go ahead and drop this little thing now so that people can know that it exists. I just bumped the camera. Sorry about that, folks, if you can't. Okay. I think we're all right. I'm going to go ahead and drop this now and people can be thinking about it. So whenever Falcon comes out, if anybody's just listened to this episode or watched this episode, the plot of Falcon is heavily inspired by a specific story. But I'm not going to say what it is until somebody comes to me and says, hey, did you get the plot for Falcon from blank? And if they're right, then I will announce to the world. But until somebody figures it out, I'm not going to say what it is. I just want to see if people even notice. I just want to see if people even go. I want to see if people read Falcon and say, hey, that was really good, I hope. But wasn't that something? Where am I? Right. So that's what I want to. That's what I want to see what happens. If somebody comes up to me and says, I think it was this, and they're right, then I'll say, yes, you win. I'll give them some prize, and I'll announce to the world. Otherwise, though, you had to figure it out. Okay. I think that will... Oh, you know what? We have one other book coming up. I'll go ahead and mention it now, so I have to do it. I've been trying for a couple of years to get this a new anthology together. The last anthology I put together, which actually won the Windy City, the Pulp Factory Award for Best Anthology, thank you guys, was The Last of the Mohicans book, Pride of the Mohicans. That's the last time I packaged an anthology. I'm going to package a new anthology coming up in the next year or so called Man vs. Robot with a cover painting by the awesome Mark Maddox. And I'll have a story in it. I know Bobby Nash will have a story in it. I'm going to round up two or three more stories, and we're going to get that book out in the next year or so. I guarantee it. Should be fun. So that's what's coming up. Last, I promised I'd recommend a couple of things for you guys that I haven't already recommended. John and I are going to do that on. We're going to talk about stuff we're currently reading on probably the next episode if we get to do a joint episode finally. So I don't have to fly solo here anymore. I promise I'm not going to do too many more solo episodes if I can help it. But yeah, I mentioned The Road to Little Dribbling, Bill Bryson. This is the book I'm getting ready to read next. Whoa, I hit the microphone. Everybody that's listening knows I just hit the microphone. So this one's coming up next, along with Concrete Blonde by Michael Connelly. And I'm really hoping that the Black Library will put out a new Horace Heresy book within the next soon. I mean, we've been waiting for another Gaunt's Ghosts up here for quite a while. I know that Dan Abnett's had some health problems, and I understand that. I dearly love Dan. He's fantastic. I hope he's – but he's been doing some other stuff. In fact, he wrote a couple of Horus Heresy books since he wrote the last Gaunt's Ghost book. So we've been waiting on the next Gaunt book for a while. Let's see if that comes up soon. All right. That's plenty and more than enough. So the Rocket is going to get on out of here for another episode. I hope that you enjoyed this little visit to the mailbox. We'll do it again sometime soon. Maybe you have some questions for John too. But by all means, send in your questions and comments. Well, you can leave them on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, be sure to let me get Mira's little sign here. Always useful to have this. Mira says, "Like and leave awesome comments." Woo! And so please do that, and please subscribe. The more subscribers this show has, the more prominent it becomes, the quicker it comes up in the searches, and the more new viewers and listeners we get. So that's for YouTube. And if you're listening on audio, go to iTunes, if you would, and give us a good rating. You can find all the episodes at whiterocketbooks.com, whiterocketbooks.com. Drop the little menu down in the top right corner, and you can see every episode. You can listen to every episode we've ever done. This is like episode 88 of the podcast and episode 2 of White Rocket TV. So the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. Thanks for watching and or listening, and we will see you guys down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.